Well, thanks, Jay. I have the privilege of working with Jay with Alberta Reformer, and this afternoon there's a breakout session with the third guy involved with Alberta Reformer, Josh Seneker, and he'll be speaking on political suffering, and so just encourage you to be able to check out his breakout. Well, now I'm going to take advantage of the fact that Terry and Juanita are here, and I just wanted to interview them, ask them some questions, and get some of their wisdom, both from their personal experience, but also in terms of their experience in ministry. And I think they've got lots to share, and so that's kind of what this little session is about. So Terry, last night you shared a little bit about your story, about the loss of Emily, and then later on, the loss of Josh. Maybe, you know, I think just trying to be very practical now, what are some of the things that you guys did in the midst of your loss that maybe could qualify as like spiritual disciplines, or what were the things, the means of grace that were helpful to you guys yourselves during those seasons of loss?
Mm-hmm. Well, my first thought on that is that as a cowboy preacher I know likes to say, we were kind of crowded into some of those things, in that just for survival, I think one of the things that we did was just pressed into the Psalms, as we've been hearing this weekend already, when we could actually read anything. But for the first little while, in kind of the deepest water, we just had to learn. I more so, because I tend to be more private, self-sufficient, kind of introvert person, just really trust other people to look after us. And I think that was one of the things that might have been really hard had we not needed it so much. So that's one of the early things, is just learn to let go and not let go and let God in that old line, but just to let go and let others look after us in terms of just invading our house and looking after prep and cleaning and helping with the younger kids, and just remembering when we couldn't pray that other people were praying for us. So that's really how it started in a lot of ways. So one of the biggest lessons in the early days was just the importance of community. We surprised our church family at how early our family got back to church, because we needed to be there. We just needed those people. We needed to, even if we didn't have the heart to sing, just to be there and soak it in. So community is kind of the first answer. So do you have a mic here?
I'm not sure. Oh, there we go. Okay. So I think as far as spiritual disciplines for myself, it was just, I sometimes say I tried to read other parts of the Bible, but I could only read the Psalms. Mm-hmm. I think my kids were at an age where I had just maybe, I had been in the habit of, I always get up early anyway, just me. And I had been in the habit of being up early, and then I just needed to be on my own. That was my time during the day to just grieve alone, you know, because I needed that time, because, you know, you have kids around, you have people around and everything. So spending the time in the Word every day, I read a lot of books in that first couple of years, first year especially, but sometimes those books I would read the first little bit and I would say, I don't agree with this. I was joking about closing the book, throwing it across the room. And yet, the next day, I would have to come back and say, okay, Lord, where's the truth in this? And keep submitting to God's word and the truth of other people's writings that were helpful for understanding just grief and God's sovereignty and all of those kinds of big questions. So, and I think listening to music for us was huge. Just, you know, going for a walk or going on the treadmill, just listening to music, just having things that were constantly feeding us with truth, because you you don't have truth inside, you know, like when you're struggling so much. So just to be reminded of that over and over was a really huge part of our growth and healing.
So you got to, you mentioned the music. I'm interested, Terry, you just hinted at it last night, but I was just curious, even what were some of the special songs? I know there were special songs and just some of that became pretty meaningful. Would you want to just share just some of those that became important to you?
Yeah, in the summer of 2008, Sovereign Grace Music introduced the Come Weary Saints album. And this is a bit of a personal insight here. I'm sharing your story. Juanita mentioned one time in the summer, this is weeks before Emily was killed, that the song It Is Not Death to Die on that album really stuck out. She said, I don't know why. And that album, and just before that, The Valley of Vision by Sovereign Grace came out as well. And just real songs of lament and wrestling with God and comfort. So those two albums were huge at that time. And as a matter of fact, you know, I mentioned last night in our testimony, it took a couple months for the police to track down the guy that killed our daughter. So we all felt fear, not just the town, but our little girls, 7 and 9 as well, felt a lot of fear. So we actually put those albums on for the girls to go to sleep to at night, every night for a long time. So providential timing with those albums, and a lot of those songs. I remember even going to the gym and being on the treadmill and having the headphones in. You know, I wasn't singing aloud, there are other people around, but just, again, not turning them off when I felt like it. You know, as long as you are glorified, you know, one of the songs is like, I don't like that sometimes. Those albums were really significant. There's a big, long story to that, too, that I won't tell now, but you can ask me personally.
More stories. So you mentioned your girls, mentioned Petra and Anne, and after Emily passed, then, you know, Josh was there, and then later on, Josh is passing. How as parents, how do you parent your family through this kind of loss and difficulty? What maybe have you learned, or what could you share?
Yes, sir.
I feel like it was a very early conversation between us in the week after Emily had died. We realized that we needed to parent the children that we had, mm-hmm. Not the child that we'd lost. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that was something that God really just helped us through. I know for sure we did not do it perfectly. Mm-hmm. We joke that we're from very, in fact, our French daughter-in-law tells us that we are very stoic. We are English and German, and we come from families that don't talk a lot about your feelings. We probably didn't talk about our feelings enough with our girls and Josh. Josh was older. He was 16, so there was a different element there. But on the other hand, we really wanted to protect their childhood. We wanted them to be kids. We wanted them to be able to go outside and play without fear, even though we were fearful for many years. It's a difficult balance, and I think it really depends a lot on your personality and your family life and your kids' personalities and all of that. Like I said, we could have talked about things more, but on the other hand, I think that in a lot of ways we did manage to hit the balance there of being open to talk about our kids, talk to them, talk about how they were feeling, but not burdening them with our burdens. And I think that's really important as parents, because it is, I mean, there was a lot of stuff happening after Emily's death, apparently, that, or especially that really was not suitable for children to hear. So just the concentration on protecting them and their innocence was kind of the focus at that point.
Amen to what Juanita said. After, just an illustration of that, after Josh died, we were in Gatineau for a few weeks back and forth, and we went back home and then back out when our grandson was born. But during that time, with Petra and Anne, I decided that we needed to go just one-on-one. I wanted to take them for a walk and go for a good long walk and talk things out. Well, halfway through the walk with Anne, she asked me kind of out of the blue, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. What was Emily like? I thought, you don't know? I thought, you were 7, you know, so it really, really struck me. So it was an opportunity to really talk about Emily and, you know, what she was like in a lot of details and things, and it was a good talk. But it's one of those don't do as we said, do as we say, not as we did kind of thing, that I think we could have been a little bit more open in talking. But at the same time, I think it was an absolute lifesaver that we didn't get and stay on the hamster wheel of just replaying and redoing. But one of the things, I was waiting for Juanita to mention it, but I'll jump in. Elizabeth Elliot talks about the poem, Do the Next Thing. And just the whole concept of if the next thing is getting out of bed in the morning or, you know, making breakfast, you know, just taking the kids to swimming lessons way too early for Juanita's comfort, but it was good for the younger girls to go to their swimming lessons. Small town, everybody knew, right? So it was uncomfortable, but just take a deep breath and do the next thing. Don't worry about the third thing down the road. Just do the next thing. And I think that was far healthier, even if we were a little bit too stoic, than constantly obsessing on all the details. So there's a balance there. And I think the girls would say we could have been more open, but they're thankful and we're close, and they're close to the Lord, and we're thankful for that.
Really helpful. So I want to ask just a couple more things about your own personal experience, and then I want to ask you maybe some wisdom about things for the church. But a couple things I want to ask, just maybe a little bit more theological or a little bit more abstract. But yesterday when we were talking, you mentioned, something I'll summarize as the Paulison move, David Paulison and this move in thinking. Do you want to just share a little bit about that kind of shift in thinking that he talks about?
It's more your thing. Yeah.
So in the book Suffering and Sovereignty of God, which is a collection of sermons from a Desiring God conference.
I think there's one left in the bookstore.
Yeah, I think there are some there. There's a message by David Paulison, and that was one of the most helpful ones in that book for me in wrestling with it. And you get near the end of this chapter. This is one of the points where I closed the book and left it till the next day or later. He says, you need to move from why me to why not me. And I was like, I'm not ready for that. Thank you very much. But over time, I think that's something that has worked on us. It's such a game changer to just really think through that change, right? And his whole message just was on how firm a foundation the song, and he walked through that, and just how through valleys and fires and all of that, God is there with you. So that was one of the ones that I really had to work through and trust. And I remember talking to Terry about this, and might have been his mom as well there. But just the fact that Emily knew the Lord. She wasn't just a girl that was from a difficult family background. I mean, the police asked us, did she ever hang around with, like, at the store or whatever? And I'm like, my children do not hang around anywhere. Thank you very much. And so we were a Christian family. We were protective. We homeschooled. You know, we kind of felt like we did all the things, right?
Yeah.
So in some ways, we knew where Emily was. We could trust that. So however awful of an act that this man did, she was safe in the Lord. Mm-hmm. So there was so much to learn and grow and understand about God's plans and purposes that we still have no idea, really. We'll only know that in glory. But it's, that was a switch of perspective for me.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Just what you said there kind of triggers even my second question along those lines. There can be a question that some people will ask is, you know, how has the Lord used this, you know, in your life, or how's he used it, as if there has to be, it has to be useful, and you have to be able to figure it out. Has that seemed obvious or less so? And even maybe just wrestling with that question, like, is that something that has been like, oh yeah, this has to be useful that we see this?
I think the short answer is, no, we don't have a clue. You know, that in some ways, we know how the Lord has changed us. But I think one of the things that the Lord drove home immediately, like in the first hours, is that he was going to carry us through. You know, so I think looking for how God is going to use us to have a platform or do this ministry or you know, affect other people's lives, it's like, Lord, you know, it's yours. We just need to survive, and you need to carry us, kind of thing. So I think that initial trajectory kind of changed our perspective. So we weren't always looking, you know, why, you know, what is the fruit of this? We know there's going to be fruit in eternity. We've heard some things, but I think just that God-given instinct to deflect is that if anything good comes out of it, it's God that does it, not us. So that's, yeah, again, not to say that there hasn't been anything, but that's not our focus, and God hasn't promised to tell us why or show us the fruit. You look at Job, and Job had all kinds of demands of the Lord, but when the Lord spoke, he says, I, you know, cover my mouth, I repent in dust and ashes. You know, God is God.
So maybe I'll switch and get you guys to share. You can share from your experience. You've already hinted at how the church was towards you, but maybe I'll also just expand it out, not just from your own experience of loss and trials, but just even your own ministry experience and what you've seen over the years. As far as then thinking practically for people in the church, how should they be responding? Let's do this. What are the do's and don'ts of how to respond when somebody is going through hard times, suffering, great loss? What's the do's and the don'ts? Don't do that. So what would you say on some of those things?
Sure. So some of the things that were super helpful, and again, this was different from Emily and Josh, because as Terry said last night, Emily's was much more public. We woke up Monday morning to her face being on a national newspaper. We were just gobsmacked. There's no other word for it with that. So it was very public. So our chairman of our board at the church actually became our media person. We existed in a bubble for
at least, yeah.
Three weeks, something like that. It was very helpful. It was a bubble that people were welcome to come into if they were part of our church, our circle, family, whatever. It's not like we were completely isolated, but it was helpful to kind of keep the world at bay, because for any of you who have been through a sudden death, there's just such a shock, you know, and so it's just having someone to kind of filter things through. The ladies organized meals for at least a month. We didn't have to cook. In fact, Terry joked last night about the extra freezer. Someone literally brought an extra chest freezer because we didn't have enough room in ours for all of the meals and everything. That was huge. One of the older ladies in our church said, "I can't do anything, but I could come and clean your bathrooms." So she did that for, I don't know, a few weeks. I don't remember how long exactly. Actually, the same thing in Quebec when Josh passed away. We were there for, there was a delay in being able to have the funeral just because of an autopsy. So Marie-Michelle's family, we were all there, and their church ladies provided meals for the 2 weeks until the funeral. And then later on, I think, as well, helped out. So those practical things are just so helpful. And, you know, there were gifts of money. There were gifts of just time helping, of whatever. Like, our girls and Josh were well looked after. Actually, almost too much. I think we had too many stuffed animals to deal with. But, you know, they still remember that. Like, they remember those kinds of, of gifts. Helpful things, even like friends saying, "Can I take the girls? They can come play." Like, yes, please. They need normal life. So if there's children involved, being able to just say what's most helpful. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that it's very helpful not to say, "Let me know if you need help." Because when you're in the middle of a shocking situation, whatever it is, whether it's sudden illness or death or whatever, your brain does not know when you need. First of all, you don't know what you need help with, and you don't know who to call. And you just do not have the capacity to ask for help. But if someone says, "Can I take your girls for the afternoon?" You're like, "Yes, that would be very helpful. Can I bring supper?" "Yes, that would be very helpful." "Can I clean your bathroom?" "Yes." Or if they just show up and do those things. All of those kinds of things. Being sensitive also, you know, like you can't just come in and take over either. But really helping the family to know that there is help available and they're not just isolated and they don't have to be the ones making all of the decisions, because there are so many decisions that you have to make that you never expected to have to deal with. I mean, just all of the logistics as well.
One quick follow-up on that is we really saw and appreciated the different giftings of the members of the body and different strengths. You know, and that's made me a little more aware of gifts I don't have, things I don't do well, and I can really appreciate how other people do things really well. Am I going to name names? Well, I get to sneak home tomorrow, so I'm going to name names. You know, like somebody like Calvin Heinrichs has a radar for a mom with a stroller that needs a door opened. And I don't notice. I'm thick on those things. I'm oblivious. You know, I'm hopeless. But, you know, Henry and Marion, Calvin and Rita, you know, they are just equipped and wired to serve in incredible ways. And they've been around long enough, and I know them, so I think I can call them out. And they probably don't get called out enough. But that is the measure of faith God has given them. That's particular gifting. So, if you're a person that is a little oblivious, and you're going to have different gifts and different things, but if you think you might have gifts and helps and hospitality and you're good at logistics and things like that, step up, because a lot of people won't know what to do, you know. So just appreciating the different members of the body and how we can help one another. It's great.
So. I have more.
Keep going.
So, yeah. One thing in the long term that I've appreciated so much, and thank you, to those who've done it. And remember people later. Remember on the anniversaries.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It means a lot to get a text years later. It says, I'm thinking of you today.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's not necessary. You know, I'm not offended that people didn't do that, but that just that extra little, I'm thinking of you, is really helpful. I had one friend who was particularly gifted at saying, oh, I remember when.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Emily did this. And I was like, thank you for saying her name.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, we don't say their names. Sometimes we're afraid to bring up the person who's passed away because we think somehow it's going to hurt. Well, it hurts way more if people don't say anything. And they always avoid the topic. It's helpful to not always ask, how are you, in that way that everybody knows, like, I'm so sorry for you, how are you today? And sometimes, honestly, I just want to say, I'm fine. You know, I actually don't want to spill my guts to you right at this moment because maybe I've just barely got myself under control and I don't want to cry again. So a friend who just says, how are you doing? And you're like, actually, it's a pretty good day. And they say, great. And then they move on from there. But if they say, how are you? And I'm like, I'm okay. And they say, do you want to talk about it? Yeah, maybe I do want to talk about it. So being sensitive to that. And there were people that were not friends of ours before that who expected entry into our personal feelings. That wasn't helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a few in particular, to be honest. So, you know, like be careful, be sensitive. Maybe you will grow a different relationship with someone who's had a loss, who's going through suffering, and after their time of suffering, maybe you'll grow that relationship and you'll grow that friendship, but don't assume that you're going to. But that doesn't mean you can't help them. You can help them by praying for them. You can help them by providing physically in whatever way they need. You can help in a lot of ways that doesn't involve a deep friendship. But maybe you are the person who is going to be that deep friend that they need. So just being sensitive and listening to cues. I had one friend in particular who was really good about just saying, hey, do you want to go for a walk? And she wasn't expecting me to be like, oh, this is the time I'm just going to tell you everything. We could talk about our kids. We could talk about life. We could do, you know, but then she would, maybe there was times I also needed to talk about how I was feeling. So there was a freedom there to kind of follow where I was myself that day. And so that was a great gift that this particular friend gave to me at that time. I'm trying to think if there's anything else, but it wasn't helpful.
Well, one thing that wasn't helpful particularly in the moment in the early days is we had a few people who identified with us because they had lost children. And a couple of them, I remember one lady standing at the door, just came and knocked on our door one time. And she basically said, you'll never get over it. Do you remember that? I was like, yeah. That wasn't particularly helpful at the time.
And I don't think we knew her either.
Just a stranger at the door. Yeah, I lost my son like 12 years ago. You'll never get over it. You know, it was like that wasn't really helpful. And the other side of that is that, oh, time heals all wounds. You know, just being a little dismissive or 6 months on going, you're still grieving? You know, that kind of. So, again, just that be sensitive. And it's kind of like, you know, signs they put up all over the place. The people that need the signs won't pay any attention to the signs, and they just irritate the rest of us. You know, so maybe I'm wasting my breath right now. But on a more serious note, I didn't use any names there. Anyway, on a more serious note, when I was talking about being a little thick and not noticing things, it reminded me of a conversation I had with a pastor and somebody I didn't know particularly at a conference. We were invited to a conference a few months later. And this man, you know, several months on, asked me directly, how are your people doing in your church? I went, okay, I guess. He said, have you asked them? Have you given them permission to talk to you? Have you given them permission to share their feelings? And I went, whoa, that's a good insight. So if you are suffering, or remember this for times of deep water, give people in your circle permission. Like, open up to them and say, hey, I'd like to talk sometime. If it's not good right now, just can we go for a walk? Can we book a time for coffee? And, you know, just really be interested in them as well. We were kind of bewildered at how many people were deeply affected by both Emily and Josh's death, but we were just in our own space, and that's understandable in the early months, but later on, just really drawing other people out, asking them to share memories, feelings, responses, that kind of thing, I think it's really helpful. So
that was great, because you guys answered everything that I wanted to get at, especially what you just said there, Terry, about people who aren't directly affected by the grief, but they're grieving too. And sometimes that's the source, it seems, of the inappropriate intrusion into your grief, because it's not actually sensitive to you, but actually they need, as Juanita was saying, they need some sense of relief from their own grief or what's going on with them. But at the same time, sometimes it's quite sincere, and then they're kind of actually suffering along, and they would just like to talk about it too. And Juanita, what you said as far as just the, if I could summarize, like, so there's different circles of relationship, and then people in the church need to just discern kind of how close are they, and then think how they can really help and not kind of jump in closer than maybe they presume. And I think sometimes just asking, you know, it seems like just asking, is this appropriate, rather than people jumping to conclusions. Maybe just on it, just to circle back on it just a little bit, is just very on a basic level, what's the instinct that people in the church should have when they see somebody going through deep waters? Is the instinct to go to them or to give space? Because I think that at a basic level is pretty much everybody's confused at that point.
Yep.
What would you say just on that real basic level?
That's interesting, because I was actually going to say sometimes people can get lost because nobody's quite sure how to approach them too. Like, you kind of think, oh, well, they have their friends, they have their family. So I think that's very important what you just said, Clint, about asking. We struggle now because I think even in my lifetime, I see a difference in, at the church level, not just at society level. It's worse in the society. But at the church level, we don't even drop by people's houses in good times. You know, like, we always have to, like, oh, well, could we meet next Tuesday? We're not like, oh, we have a free night. Let's just go see if they're home, you know? Whereas when I was growing up, I felt like that was much more common. Maybe it's partly because both my parents are from farming communities, and so I think that plays into it as well, the city versus the rural. But maybe we just plain need to be better at, before there's difficult circumstances, just being in each other's lives on a little bit more casual basis. You know, like, yeah, okay, it's Friday night at 6:30, we don't have anything on. Hey, you guys doing something? You know, like, just kind of, just being a little bit more open that way, because I think I personally feel like, oh, I don't want to bother you. You know, like, should we come to the hospital? Should we come to your home? Should we? Because, like, it might be an intrusion. Well, I actually don't know that it is. I mean, the first couple of days after Emily's death especially, we had people there constantly, and it would be, from our very introverted selves, might have seemed like this was not the right thing, but it was actually quite helpful. Mm-hmm. So it's a fine line, but maybe we just need to be better at asking questions, and we also need to be better at just being open and just practicing that now, right? So that it becomes, we normalize it now, yeah. So that we know that we can do it later.
I think that's an excellent insight. Just reflecting, you know, 3 years in at Sherwood Park, if that had happened now, as opposed to 11 years in a small town, you know, just generationally, you know, just the way people responded. I just think of some of the key leaders that stepped in and looked after us. That's, nowadays you have to send a text, you know, ahead of time, you know, kind of thing, and get permission. No smartphones in 2008. There wasn't wide adoption anyway. It is really different. I hadn't really thought about that. But we, book recommendation, The Compelling Community by Mark Dever and Jamie Dunlop. Excellent book to think about developing a gospel counterculture in a lot of ways. It might be a good place to start to kind of, and I'm not saying you're not good at it, but to really counter what the world is pushing at us.
If I can just add in my own observations in some of these kinds of seasons, is that I think it's great for people to develop that initiative to go visit, to go say, to go offer something, but just to have low expectations. And so, because what the it goes bad when you take the initiative to take the casserole or stop by or whatever it is. But then you've got a high expectation that, oh, well, I'm thinking they're going to be very happy to see me, and they're going to want to give us their whole evening, give us 3 hours tonight. And you didn't realize, well, actually, they're exhausted before you open the door. But if you go and you initiate with low expectation, it's kind of like they tell pastors when you go do a hospital visit.
Yep.
You know, they tell us, you go, you say a few solid words, read scripture, pray, and then you get out of there.
Yep.
Don't overstay your time, and then it's just right. But if you stay too long, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And so low expectation, but taking some initiative might be a way, and or at least that's what I've seen.
Yeah, it's excellent. Good, thanks.
Just on thinking about now, maybe I'll just switch a little bit more practical stuff, just from ministry and things like that. I think it's really important that we are talking about not only suffering, but also death and end of life. What are some of the practical things that you think Christians need to be thinking about more so in view of just living in, not only living in light of eternity, but living in light of the brevity of life? What are some of the things that you would recommend or suggest that we should be thinking about practically in the church?
This seems, some of you may be surprised by this. One of the biggest things is, honestly, have a will. Because our son, I mean, they'd only been married four and a half years. They just bought a house, you know, all those things. They were kind of thinking, oh, yeah, we need to get a will. They didn't. It was 6 years of our daughter-in-law's of really, really hard work that she had to do because of the laws in Quebec. I'm not sure if they're the same here, especially when there's children involved. It becomes very complicated. Yeah. And she is the one that is always pushing people, just make sure you have a will, especially when there's children involved, because that is a gift you're going to give to the spouse who's left behind. And it doesn't, you don't have to spend thousands of dollars like you can literally do at free online thing. You can go to registries, you can pay $40 there, whatever it is that you're able to do now, have something written down that will help your spouse and or whoever is involved in distributing the estate, because it's very difficult legally otherwise.
Yeah, practically speaking, I'm almost feeling a little bit stumped here. Maybe.
Yeah. I will add one other thing. My mom and dad for years did a seniors ministry, and there's a surprising number of older people who don't want to think about death. We do have to think about it. We have to plan for it. It's just one of those things that, again, it's a gift to the people who are left behind. So,
one thing, and again, this might seem like a bit of a curveball. Read Christian biography. If hard seasons in life surprise you, you're going to realize, if you've been reading a lot of Christian biography, that hard times and suffering are really normal, are really common throughout your heroes of the faith, that you've heard, maybe heard their names but don't know their stories and how much deep water they went through and how God used even that, you know, to deepen their witness and their effectiveness in their generation and generations to come. Another thing too that is related to that, read fiction. Develop your soul, develop your sense of sympathizing and really identifying with a variety of people, and good fiction can really help us to do that. If you're just a pragmatic, I'm never going to read fiction, you know, I'm not going to read biography, I just want to read theology or practical stuff that helps with my work, you're missing out on a big part of life, and you're not building a foundation for, you know, seasons of sorrow or even seasons of deep reflection. So.
I know I'm interviewing you guys, but I'm gonna maybe offer just some comments, just my own opinions. Again, like I said the other night, it's my conference, so I just tease them.
For a comment.
But on this theme, being practical, just the last couple of years, and especially just in the last year, watching my dad go through a roller coaster with cancer, and then he passed away just before Christmas. For my wife and I, we got to see, thinking about end-of-life issues for the elderly, we got to see up close the challenges that I think even Christians, but certainly in society, that a lot of people there just don't want to cope with, they don't want to think about and don't want to deal with. And so I think it's really important, one, that we have to really reclaim an understanding of the dignity of the elderly, the dignity of a human soul, even if they're no longer useful. And that is different than a lot in the institutional medical communities can kind of treat people. The second thing is that out of love, we need to be advocating for the elderly, for people who are sick, for people who are going through trial. They need to be advocated for. I can't think of how many times with loved ones that if there wasn't family there to advocate for the person that's in the hospital bed, who knows what would have happened. My dad was offered MAID, and you know, if he's on some drugs and stuff, like he might have gone for it had not family been there to advocate and really protect him. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is, I think as Christians, we really have to think about how do we bear witness to the gospel through end of life, and preserving the dignity of people, but just recognizing death is part of the curse, and then highlighting the hope of the resurrection, really having that in mind rather than this avoidance. Because the avoidance, and I think it all kind of fits in with all the kinds of suffering. There's people that they just don't want to talk about it. So they're not going to talk to you about your suffering. They don't want to bring it up because you mentioned it in your talk, Terry. They actually, their mortality is, you know, they're thinking about that. So they don't want to talk about it. That's why people don't go to funerals. It's also why a funeral director told me that he had only done actually 10 burials in the whole year. All cremation. And I'm not saying you can't have cremation ever. I don't think it's preferable. I don't think it's really the Christian option, but there can be liberty there. At the same time, people are moving to that. They want things out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we have to, in all of this, when people are suffering or people are in, they're sick, they're end of life, instead of putting it out of sight, out of mind, get in there, initiate. Maybe with low expectations, but initiate. And I think that's going to pay dividends. You guys want to comment a little bit on that, on just anything that way?
Yeah. Related to that, an extension of that is, and I'm going to step on some toes and I don't care. Death is an enemy. Death is a result of the curse related to sin. We still die because of sin, even though we are in Christ. And I've seen a trend, especially for older folks. I remember my mom, who died in 2010, would be so sad and so upset after she came back from funerals of friends of hers, because it was a celebration of life. And it was all business as usual. There was a lot of laughter. There wasn't really a sense of sobriety. It was just wrong, and it really bothered my mom, and it bothers me. And when I do funerals, praise the Lord, I haven't done one for a while, but did a lot of them in Edson especially, I always lead with that with a family, that, you know, even if it's a non-Christian family, is that, you know, I'm not going to say you're not allowed to call it a celebration of life, and I kind of get where that comes from. But I said, as a Christian, I recognize that death is an enemy, and death is something to be mourned and thought about deeply and soberly, you know. So that's kind of the tone that, you know, certainly my message and my part is going to have in your funeral. So it's a relatively new thing, and it's a part of the suppressing the truth and unrighteousness to be all light and flippant and pretend like nothing's wrong at a funeral. It's just wrong. So anyway.
I co-sign on that one, Terry. Mm-hmm. Completely agree. Yeah. And even what you preached, the possibility that, or just the fact that as Christians, even now, cultivating this good, godly ability to lament, yep, to point stuff out that this is sad, this is bad, this is painful, but to be able to call it out to the Lord,
yeah,
and then have hope that the Lord will make all right in the end. That habit, I think, is something we cultivate. And then when you have a funeral, then you can speak honestly like that. Mm-hmm. And yet it can still have hope on the other side, as we hope in the Lord.
Yep.
Well, it's been very helpful. Yeah, go ahead. You've got more. Keep it coming.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just was thinking, and you can add to this as we go, I think one thing that is helpful for us to reflect on is the healing that comes through times of grief,
yeah,
suffering, whether it's a long-term illness. Terry and I were talking about this on the way over this morning. There was a point at which we were invited to a pastor's conference in Maryland about 6 months or so after Emily's death. We went knowing nobody. We were well taken care of. They invited us specifically because of what had happened. And at one point in one of the services, they said, if you would like prayer as a pastoral couple, put up your hands. And I mean, you know, we're Canadian. we're like, okay. And so we did put up our hands and people prayed for us. I really look back on that as a significant point at which the Lord started to heal our hearts. And I have talked to people over the years about, I think it's important to pray for healing. That, yeah, God will heal your grief. It will never leave you. And everybody deals with their grief in different ways. I mean, some people do think of the person they've lost every day. I don't, personally. But it doesn't mean that it's not there. It's just you know, it just comes out at different times. So I'd say pray for healing and kind of wait for God's timing in that as well, because it may be a short period, it may be a long period. But whatever it is, God will bring you through, and he will bring you to a certain measure of trust and equilibrium and just being able to go on with life. And I think going on with life is important, and not getting stuck as much as you're able. And we all are different spots, whether we deal with mental illness or depression or anxiety, and some of us will never go beyond a certain level, and yet that's the level at which God is going to take us through whatever it is. So I think that's an important thing to ask for.
Yeah. Yeah, on the way over, you also mentioned the rest of Philippians 4:6, how it extends into verse 7. Yeah. So do you want to
talk about the ladies that? This later.
Oh, okay, well then forget it. Yeah, save it for the ladies.
Yeah, I'll save it for the ladies. You can tell the men later. There was something else that went through my mind.
No, that's really good. I think just picking up on that, I'm going to mention this. You're not all going to be here tomorrow morning, but in my sermon tomorrow, talking about the comfort of God, we can't be afraid as Bible people, as conservative, you know, more reformed-leaning folks, of the supernatural. Pray for healing in this. Pray for God's supernatural power to do what you can't do. And that's part of what, you know, an aspect I didn't mention in our being carried. We really do believe that that was God's supernatural help. Because we're his children, we can ask, and he will help. So.
And with that, I think it shows as well, being able to testify of how God has carried you is also a means of ministry to each other. And so if you have been carried in some way, you can share that with other people, and they will be reminded, oh yeah, maybe God can carry me too.
Yes.
And that's part of the reason why I wanted Terry and Winnie to share with us. And so I want to thank you guys for just opening your hearts and your sharing your wisdom about these things. Mm-hmm. And with that, I think it's time. I think we're going to, I'm going to let Jared tell us what we're going to do, because he actually is running things.
No. I was actually just, we have a little bit of extra time. Just one question. You could both answer it. You'd mentioned kind of biographies or fiction literature. Is there anything in particular, biography or fiction literature, that you found helpful that you would recommend people to read?
Well, a really accessible, simple way to get started, I'll just leave it there for the recommendation, is listening to and then reading the short biographies by John Piper that he prepared for like over 20 years in a row at his annual pastor's conference. And I, for one, and I've known other people too, that when they hear a talk on Cooper or on David Brainerd or somebody like that, they go and find an extended length biography, but it's a great way to get started. So just go to Desiring God. There are books that are available that might have, you know, three of them in one volume, or you just listen to the MP3s, and that would really I think get you going on some of the key biographies to read. So a bit of a shortcut answer. So.
Okay, so let's just go with the books. So Juanita, you mentioned the collection of talks from Piper's conference, Suffering and the Sovereignty of God. So that's in book form. Any others that you guys would recommend? And then I'm going to throw one out. Just about grief and suffering. And
There's one by Nancy Guthrie. It's one of her, I think it was her first book, actually. Hope for the Grieving Family, something to that. Look up Nancy Guthrie, you'll find it. And I have a whole shelf full at home. There's one by Ligon Duncan, also on grieving, that I think was quite good. Those are the kind of the first two that come to mind. Oh, Tim Challies, the one about losing his son.
Seasons of Sorrow.
Seasons of Sorrow. Yeah, that was that was really, really helpful. And actually, I'll mention a new book. It's called On Getting Out of Bed. Well, newish. It's about 6 months old. By Alan Noble. It's very short. Terry and I both read it right after Christmas. It's particularly geared to someone with depression, mental illness. But as we read it, we felt like he was speaking our story in going through a time of grief. There's one little caveat with it. Just some people might find one little bit to be a little bit too much self-help. But I think if you take it in context. But his biggest thing is just how to put one foot in front of the other when you have no strength to do so. And if you, we discussed it at a book club, and some of the people, some of the ladies didn't really like it as much, but they said it's because I haven't gone through it. And I think it's really helpful for people who haven't gone through it to read a book like that to understand that it is incredibly difficult to get out of bed some days. And so when you're going through this, so that would be a new one that I would recommend.
Yeah, it's called On Getting Out of Bed by Alan Noble. And again, you know, don't endorse everything he wrote necessarily, but that one little snapshot, that insight, it's very helpful. So. Mm-hmm.
My mother, during my dad's late illness, she was reading Challies, Seasons of Sorrow. Very helpful for her. Mm-hmm. And I'll just mention, because Jared commented on the book, Horatius Bonner, Night of Weeping, it's... I've given it out the most of probably any book to sufferers, and there's a chapter in it. It's actually all very short. It's called The Family Badge. And Bonner basically argues that suffering is as if it's the family crest. It's what distinguishes you as being adopted into God's family, and that shows that you're entitled to the inheritance. Is that you suffer. And so when you start seeing the meaning of it, it becomes then something that, oh yeah, okay, this is then this reminder mm-hmm. of who I belong to. Yeah. And then it becomes very precious. Mm-hmm. So,
Can I add two more Puritans?
Keep going.
The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment by Jeremiah Burroughs.
Yeah.
It's gold.
Yeah.
Just read it slowly and absorb it and then read it again. And The Bruised Reed by
Richard Sibbes.
Richard Sibbes is also,
yeah.
I believe I read those both in the winter before Emily died, and I think that they were an incredible preparation for that season that was coming up. So highly recommend those.
Thanks, guys. I'm going to turn